Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. As I said, I'm Jonathan Sternberg, and I represent the appellant, Carolyn Holmes. Mrs. Holmes brought a wrongful death FELA case against the Union Pacific Railroad, alleging that her husband, Robert Holmes, had died of lung cancer caused by years of toxic exposure during his work for the railroad. The Jackson County Trial Court below, however, dismissed her case solely because a Clay County court didn't grant her application for letters to become personal representative of her late husband's estate until 6 days after the deadline the trial court had set for her to amend her petition to state so, and it refused to allow her to amend her petition at that time. Your Honors, refusing to allow Mrs. Holmes to amend her petition once she had been granted the letters to truthfully state so was unfair, was unjust, and was an abuse of what this court in the Costa case in 2008 called a trial court's, quote, limited discretion to deny such an amendment. This court should reverse the trial court's judgment and remand this case for further proceedings. The law of Missouri is and must be that as part of deciding cases on the merits wherever possible rather than on technicalities, the trial court can't refuse to allow a plaintiff to cure a deficiency in her petition and instead dismiss her case. Rather, under Rules 5533A and 6706, if a deficiency in the original petition leading to a dismissal is curable, upon that dismissal, the trial court must allow the plaintiff to amend her petition to cure it if the plaintiff asks to do so.
Is it a matter of time, Mr. Sternberg? Is it a matter of 6 days, over 10 days, over 30 days, over 60 days, or what's the line here?
No, it's not a matter of time, Your Honor. In the Black case, when Your Honor was on the Court of Appeals, Judge Draper, you wrote that Rule 6706 presumes the trial court has sustained the defendant's motion to dismiss before it considers granting leave to amend and later determining dismissal with prejudice will occur should plaintiff fail to amend in a timely fashion. So at that point, it's whatever the trial court has set, even after the dismissal. In the Costa case in 2008, where just as here, the plaintiff had filed a post-judgment motion after the dismissal, asking for permission to amend the petition at that time, and the trial court denied it, this court held that that was a timely request under 6706 and 5533, and the trial court had to grant it and reversed the trial court for failing to do so. So here, similarly, denying Mrs. Holmes her day in court and any relief from the railroad causing her husband's wrongful death simply because a different court hadn't made her the personal representative of his estate until a few days after the date the trial court had set violates these principles, violates 5533, violates 6706, and it departs from Missouri's consistent holdings for over 100 years that a plaintiff's capacity is a question of form, not substance. It's something that can be cured at any time. And I'll note that now, unlike in both the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, the railroad has abandoned its prior argument, which was its main argument, that not being appointed a personal representative before filing an FELA suit isn't curable because it has something to do with subject matter jurisdiction. Well, that's not true. We show in our opening brief, and as this court held in both the Payton case in 2008 and also way back in the Citrin case in 1907, both of which we cite in our brief, the law allows the plaintiff to cure her capacity in that manner, and it always relates back to filing the original petition. Payton's almost directly on point to this end. In Payton, what happened was there was a wrongful death case. It wasn't an FELA case, but it was an ordinary Missouri wrongful death case. And the original plaintiff, was not the personal representative of the estate. It was the decedent's granddaughter who didn't have the capacity to file such a case. But later was allowed to substitute the actual personal representative, who was the plaintiff's daughter, and that was held for statute of limitations purposes to relate back. And that's because this is a question of form, not substance. It's capacity, not standing, and it has nothing to do with the court's subject matter jurisdiction, especially after the Webb case. Instead, what we have here is a pretty straightforward issue. It's just controlled by the ordinary five factors that this court and the Court of Appeals have announced time and time again since the promulgation of these rules for whether to allow an amendment, all of which are in Mrs. Holmes's favor. And the cardinal one is about hardship. Mrs. Holmes is, and the other side wants to downplay this because the trial court called this a dismissal without prejudice. But in point of fact, this is a dismissal with prejudice, because Mrs. Holmes's cause of action for wrongful death under the FELA will be dismissed forever. Unlike in ordinary cases, Missouri's savings statute does not apply to federal cause of action under the FELA. So because he's outside the three-year statute of limitations, this operates as a dismissal with prejudice. The reason for her failure to include the matter earlier, in their brief, the railroad wants to say that this was some kind of strategy or intentional problem. That's not true. This was, and I wasn't the trial counsel, but, you know, the trial counsel was clearly apologetic about this. It was an oversight. It was an inadvertence. It wasn't strategy. And it, again, was something that was easily curable. And this court and the U.S. Supreme Court in the Wolf case way back when have allowed to be cured time and time again without a problem. The time, Judge Draper, you asked about timeliness. Well, timeliness here, she asked only a day after being appointed personal representative to file her her amended petition. And then once the trial...
question, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Hi, counsel. I had a question.
Yes,
did I understand correctly from your brief that you have an alternative argument that even if this court believes that the trial court has more discretion than you think the trial court does, that it exercised this discretion on based on two errors of law, one that it was an issue of standing rather than capacity, and the second that it thought it could make a determination in this case whether or not she was properly a personal representative when that was an issue that was in a separate case that was being separately contested and is now on appeal and not part of this case.
A few points in response to that, Your Honor. First, I wouldn't necessarily call it an alternative argument. I don't think the trial court ultimately was saying that there was a lack of standing or subject matter jurisdiction, because if you look at its actual order dismissing the case, it states at the very end that its real reason for doing so was that plaintiff failed to be appointed as personal representative before filing this cause of action or in the prescribed time in this court's previous order dated March 4th, not 2019. So basically he's saying that because we didn't amend or we weren't appointed personal representative by April 3rd, 2019, that's the reason he's dismissing the case. And that's arbitrary. I mean, that's the thrust of our argument. But as to this notion about timeliness, actually, Your Honor, reading the trial court's decision, and this is pages 3 and 4 of document number 24, I think he was holding that we actually did this within, that we could have become the personal representative within the time that we asked for it. And the time that, as he said in the order, the prescribed time in the previous order dated March 4th, it's the railroad for the first time ever, now in this court, this isn't even an argument they made in the Court of Appeals. If you look at their brief there, the railroad is arguing that these letters were invalid in some way. And as we point out in the reply brief, that's not something the trial court could have decided here. It's not something the trial court did decide. And it's not something that's before this court at this point either. I mean, I found a case that's just about directly on point to that end, the McIntyre case in this court in 1920, that says in an FELA case, a railroad can't criticize the timeliness of a personal representative. Back then it was called an administrator's appointment. So I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you, counsel.
Well, going on, we were talking about timeliness because that's the fourth factor, and the third factor, and it's an important factor. But here, it really was just one day after. And we have there are cases we cite, which I'll note that the railroad doesn't address or doesn't really offer any response to, where you have a dismissal 4 days later. The plaintiff asked to amend, the trial court says no, and this court or the Court of Appeals reversed. The Willman case from 1986 is one of them. They don't address that. There's the Boyd case, which they don't address at all, from the Court of Appeals in 1980. There was 1 week after the dismissal. Here, I think it was 4 or 5 days after the dismissal, we filed a motion for reconsideration. And I know there's no such thing as a motion for reconsideration. But in like the Taylor case and a couple of other cases we cite in our reply brief, this court always has held that this is a question, again, of form and not, titling. And what we were asking for in that motion for reconsideration was simply to be able to file an amended petition now. And under Rule 6706, the trial court, as this court held in the Costa case, had to give us that ability. And this amendment certainly would cure the only deficiency that was ever identified, and that was that my client failed to be appointed personal representative before filing her action. And I again appreciate that in the caption of her original petition, it says Carolyn Holmes, personal representative of the estate of Robert V. Holmes. Your Honor, this is one of a series of cases that my client's Pro Hoc Vici trial counsel and his firm have filed against the Union Pacific Railroad and other railroads around the country about toxic exposure. This one just happened to be in Missouri State Court. I think he assumed that she already had been appointed personal representative and inadvertently didn't make sure that that was the case. But again, this amendment would have cured that, just as in all the other cases we cite, just as in all the other FELA cases that allowed exactly this. Finally, is there any injustice to the railroad? Absolutely not. The Court of Appeals held in the Clark case that this kind of injustice isn't measured by whether the party would suffer financial loss, but whether the party is deprived of a legitimate claim or defense because it was caught by surprise. Here, before even formal discovery, I know they want to say some discovery had occurred, there hadn't been any depositions or back and forths of interrogatories and requests for declarations and that sort of thing. Before even formal discovery, that wouldn't be possible. And I'll note the railroad itself stated below and in its brief, it's page 12 of the railroad's brief, citing document 21, where they alternatively requested a 120-day continuance. My client certainly wouldn't have objected to that. They agreed that that would have been sufficient to cure any problem that they would have suffered. Your Honors, in our opening brief, pages 26 to 28, we cite numerous cases where exactly in this circumstance, the refusal to allow an amendment was reversed as an abuse of discretion. In response, the railroad doesn't cite any authority where the refusal to allow an amendment in these kinds of circumstances was affirmed. That's because none exists. Every time in these circumstances that a trial court has dismissed a petition rather than allowing an amendment that would have cured the deficiency, it has been reversed. Costa says even after the dismissal itself under 6706. Holding the contrary, as the trial court did here, that this early on in the case, only days after the deadline it had set, the petition shouldn't be amendable to make this change in form rather than substance, departs from the century of law that is in favor of allowing exactly this amendment. As I started by saying, this is unjust, it's unfair, and as all the cases we cite, it's an abuse of discretion. This court should reverse the trial court's judgment and remand this case for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hasten, you may continue.
May it please the court. The principal issue in this case is whether the appellant has established the excusable neglect necessary to support a second request for leave to amend after her counsel missed the deadline that the court imposed when it first granted leave to amend. On March 4, 2019, the Circuit Court of Jackson County gave the appellant 30 days to file an amended petition. The deadline for doing so was April 3rd. Counsel failed to meet that deadline and in doing so violated a court order. The trial court acted properly in denying the second request for a leave to amend. There was absolutely no showing of excusable neglect and the appointment as personal representative was void. Furthermore, trial counsel included a false statement as to capacity at three points in the petition and, despite assurances to the contrary, acted in a dilatory manner in curing the issue. Trial courts must be able to control their dockets and enforce their orders. They must have the power to say, enough is enough. To obtain more time to file an amended petition, the appellant had to establish excusable neglect under Rule 44.01, subsection B. The decisional law of this state is very clear on what is and what is not excusable neglect. Excusable neglect is not carelessness. It is not inattention, and it is not willful disregard. Rather, excusable neglect is an unexpected or unavoidable hindrance or accident. As applied to facts of this case, excusable neglect is not making conscious decision to forego expenses in a gamble on a favorable ruling. The conscious decision to gamble on a favorable ruling approaches willfulness. Furthermore, excusable neglect is not waiting until 21 days into a period of 30 days of leave to do anything to cure the defect in the petition. The most important factor in determining whether excusable neglect is present is the reason why the deadline could not have been met. Appellant has never offered a good reason in this case. As Mr. Sternberg, my colleague, told the court, Ms. Holmes, Pro Hoc Vici counsel, is experienced FELA counsel and had brought suits similar to this all over the United States. They knew at the time that the petition was filed that the Federal Employers Liability Act imposed a personal representative requirement on a wrongful death action. They misrepresented that fact and as authorities that are cited in both briefs as well as the appendix, this was a recurring issue for them. Furthermore, the council made no efforts to remedy this problem until almost a year into the lawsuit. And again, in doing so, they violated Judge Rohn's order. The facts of this case do not evidence any unexpected or unavoidable hindrance. That should end the inquiry. The trial court also could have concluded that the amendment would have been futile and there was no reason to grant leave to amend anyway. Missouri law imposes a one-year statute of limitations to open an estate. This court's decision in Akers and Mickles recognized this. There is one exception for a lost chance of survival, which this court has noted generally applies in malpractice cases. This is not a malpractice case, and this exception is inapplicable. In Mickles and Johnson, this court rejected other efforts to impose some sort of equitable exception to the one-year statute of limitations, and this court rejected those efforts, noting that creating such exceptions was in the legislature's prerogative. The facts of this case clearly show that the statute of limitations was not complied with. In her petition, the plaintiff admitted that her husband passed away on July 3rd, 2015. In briefing in the trial court, her counsel admitted that she did not petition to become personal representative or open estate until March 25th of 2019. This court can take the lawyer's representations at face value in determining whether the probate court of another county had the statutory authority to act. Every fact necessary to show that the petition was untimely has been admitted. Now, the cases that Mr. Sternberg cites in his brief generally apply a rule that when the record of the other court is silent as to facts necessary to show whether the court can exercise statutory authority, that the court will presume that those facts are present here. This court need not indulge in that presumption because the record of the probate division will show that the statutory prerequisites for it to act were not present. An application for probate must state the decedent's date of death, which again was July 3rd, 2015.
Judge Stiffen, for you, counsel.
Yes.
Hi, counsel. My understanding is that the probate court has found they were timely, and you're trying to collaterally attack that in another case by a court of equivalent jurisdiction. Where's your authority that one circuit court can overrule another circuit court's ruling as opposed to needing to intervene and take that up on appeal?
Well, 2 points in response to that, Your Honor. First of all, Union Pacific has intervened in the probate division. Our application has been opposed on the grounds that we have no basis for intervening there. And so if that argument is correct, then the FILA action is the only area where we can attack this.
But what is your authority that one circuit court can overrule a final decision of another circuit court?
When that judgment is void, Your Honor, this court has recognized that collateral attacks.
Things are only void if there's no jurisdiction, and clearly a probate court has jurisdiction to determine whether or not to grant letters. You're saying they're wrong, but that's not jurisdictional. Our cases are clear in Missouri.
Your Honor, I would direct the court to its decisions in Precythe, in which this court held that a attempt by a circuit court to impose a third term of probation, that order was void, and that was not sounding in jurisdictional. That was a statutory limitation.
In our case, the Webb case says that's a matter of authority, but that one case, I don't know if it said jurisdiction or not, but you're talking about something on appeal. We're in another circuit court, and you're saying they can overrule a case that's now up on appeal, I take it, or is final in another circuit court and not appealed. And again, I'm not aware of any precedent for that. Do you have any precedent for that?
Again, Your Honor, just because the exceedance of statutory authority in the Spicer and the Precept cases, those were discussions of statutory authority that rendered those decisions void.
And you so don't have a separate circuit court said that they were void and reversed in a.
Your Honor, we cited the Linville case, I believe it was, in the brief. I believe that was a 1941 decision in which this court held that in a quiet title action, the appointment of a personal representative who had transferred property that appointment was subject to collateral attack in the quiet title action.
Okay, we'll check that out. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you. And so, again, I would point to the court, the Lambert decision, which I believe Webb has changed the way we discuss this, but the Lambert decision in its third category of jurisdiction, which they call jurisdictional competency, I believe post-Webb we would talk about that in terms of exceedances of statutory authority, but the point remains that the legislature has imposed limitations on when courts are able to act in the orders that they are able to enter. And when those...
Counsel, let me ask you something. You cited a couple cases here. You said Freesite and Lambert. Are those in your table of authorities you submitted here at all?
I know that we cited those, Your Honor. Whether or not they should have been in the table of authorities, it was discussed in the last section of our brief, Your Honor. And Your Honor, I will provide the page numbers. I apologize. Your Honor, we discussed these at pages 50 to 50, 47 to the conclusion of our brief that includes this discussion, Your Honor. And the discussion about pre-sites specifically, Your Honor, was was on page 50, Your Honor. And so because these actions were in exceedance of the probate division statutory authority, under this court's decisions, those attacks are subject to, those rulings are subject to collateral attack and are reviewable in these actions. But to get on my point again, even if Holmes had established excusable neglect, and which he had not, and established that the amendment would not have been futile, she must still show that the circuit court abused its discretion in denying leave to amend. And the abuse of discretion as articulated by the decisional law of this state is extraordinarily differential. If reasonable people could disagree, there is no abuse of discretion. An abuse of discretion must clearly be against the logic of the circumstances. The act must be so arbitrary and so unreasonable as to shock the sense of justice and indicate that the court did not carefully consider this matter. And under this standard, the trial court did not abuse its discretion. No rule ever requires that leave to amend be granted. And amendments have been denied when there was no new information that could not have been included in the initial petition. Courts generally look to four factors in determining whether to grant leave to amend. And three of those factors weigh in favor of Union Pacific, where at least Judge Round in Jackson County certainly could have determined that they could have. First, the reason for the moving party's failure to include the matter in the original petition. Ms. Holmes, again, was represented by experienced FELA counsel who knew that FELA imposed a personal representative requirement in wrongful death actions.
Judge Breckenridge has a question, counsel.
Sure.
Yes, sir. Could you address the issue if the trial court was relying on a mistake of law, that in fact is an abuse of discretion? If he was mistaken as to the law when he exercised his discretion, that is an abuse of discretion.
Sure, Your Honor, and I'm not sure which a question of law Ms. Holmes contends Judge Round made a decision on. But as I read Judge Round's decision, there were alternative bases for the decision not to grant leave to amend. He could have denied it because there was no excusable neglect that was ever established. He could have denied it because he did not think that there was anything new in the proposed amendment that could not have been there before. And so there were discretionary factors that I think provide an adequate basis for Judge Round's decision to deny leave to amend. Again, FELA requires that the plaintiff be the personal representative, that this has never been disputed. Plaintiff's counsel knew it at the time that they filed the petition in Jackson County because they had litigated in previously, and they have cited cases themselves that show that they had pre-existing knowledge that before they filed this petition in Jackson County, that they had litigated this issue and knew it would be an issue. Again, the petition was counseled or captioned in the name of the personal representative. So the fact was there, plaintiff's counsel just misrepresented it. With respect to the timeliness of the application to amend, plaintiff has admitted that she could have obtained appointment at any time after her husband passed away on July 3rd, 2015, but made no efforts to do so until March 25th of 2019. Plaintiff had more than adequate time to obtain appointment both before the suit was filed and before the court's April 3rd deadline. 3 years is certainly adequate amount of time to obtain appointment. And furthermore, Union Pacific first raised this issue in November 2018 when it alerted plaintiff's pro hoc vice counsel that it was having issues with the collection of medical records and needed proof of appointment before medical providers would give authority to those releases that had been executed in that capacity. Union Pacific moved to dismiss after no action was taken on December 21st, 2018. In responding to Union Pacific's motion, plaintiff's counsel said that they would seek appointment, quote, instantly. She did not do so. On March 4th, 2019, the court granted leave to amend, presumably relying on Mrs. Holmes' counsel's representation that the matter had been taken care of, and granted 30 days to file an amended petition. Instead, the lawyers waited 21 days to file the application for probate after leave was granted, and because they waited 21 days, they were unable to comply with the circuit court's deadline to obtain appointment and file an amended petition. Just to put this in context, the April 3rd deadline was approximately 1,370 days after the decedent died, and Mrs. Holmes has admitted that she could have applied for this appointment at any time. I see that my time is up. If there are any further questions, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, I thank the court for the privilege of appearing pro hoc vice and ask that the court affirm the judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Sternberg.
Can you see and hear me, Your Honor?
I can.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in response. Excusable neglect is not the standard here. This excusable neglect is just where you're dealing with a deadline that somebody blew. This is an issue of 5533A that at the time we requested the leave to amend the petition, what was the standard at that time? And it wasn't excusable neglect. It was the standard five factors under 5533A. They have no authority that says asking for leave to amend a petition out of time, generally it's always going to be out of time if you haven't done so in the period of service by the other side. So they have no authority that applies it that way. And in the Neenan case from the Court of Appeals, which I believe Judge Stith joined, they held that for a counterclaim, the standard out of time, the standard 5533A factors apply. I just looked up the Precite case. It's the State X Rail something versus Precite. That's where it was in their brief. That's this court granting a writ of prohibition against a trial court who is imposing a third term of probation outside of statutory authority. That doesn't support a collateral attack on a separate circuit court's judgment. There is no authority that supports a collateral attack in the way they're asking. Also, I note that this is a motion to dismiss. The court is limited to the arguments that were made below in support of the motion to dismiss. And at no time ever did the railroad make this argument until this court, until its substitute brief in this court, that our letters were somehow void. Your Honors, the letters were not void. There is a statute that allows letters to be issued outside of a one-year period. My client invoked that statute. I'll note those materials are not in the record. That would be better handled by the Court of Appeals and the pending appeal from the probate court's denial of their request to revoke our letters. And there, it wasn't a question of standing either. Judge Chamberlain in Clay County held that we had correctly invoked a statute that allowed the court to enter the letters. So they're not void either. As for an issue of law, I think what Judge Breckenridge was referring to was this issue about saying that we were without subject matter jurisdiction. I don't know if that was an alternative reason for the trial court's judgment, but it does mention that in its order granting the motion to dismiss over and over again. And if that is, if the court finds that that was a reason, then yes, that's reviewed de novo, because predicating an exercise of discretion on a misapplication or misdeclaration of law is reviewed de novo, as in, I think, it's State versus Taylor that we cite in our standard of review. I want the court to remember that above all, in reviewing a decision denying leave to amend, an appellate court looks to see whether justice is furthered or subverted by the course taken. This perverted, it's subverted the course of justice here. My client is left without relief, and there's simply no reason for that. We ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Case will be taken as heard and submitted.